not give a talk today and take advantage of this time to have a more open discussion, mostly responding to your thoughts, your questions, and things. We've had this Sunday morning program now for, well, since March, and mostly just a series of talks that I give or other people give. And I thought it might be nice to actually develop an idea. And very often, the ways in which we think about something is much more complicated than just thinking about it. It's often an emotional reaction, physical reaction to the experience. So it's quite common for people who have strong physical pain, for example, or any kind of pain. If they're really attentive to what's going on, you can notice how your reaction to that, the secondary reaction, actually causes the muscles to tighten up around it or tighten up around your head and something, and it gets worse. And I talked about this some months ago. I had a splitting headache. It was really more than I've usually ever had. And I had to drive, and maybe I shouldn't have been driving, but for a while I was just feeling sorry for myself. And while I was feeling sorry for myself, it was a lot worse. And then finally I remembered, you know, I know something different than being, you know, I know how to do something different than feeling sorry for myself. Why don't I just practice mindfulness with this? And as soon as I could pay attention to the rawness of the pain, it was a lot, you know, I was quite manageable and quite easy. And then after a while I kind of forget to pay attention to the pain, and then pretty quickly then I'd slip into my self-pity, and it would get really bad again. And then, okay, if it got bad enough, I'd get my attention. Okay, I know something to do here. So I would let go of the self-pity and just be there with the rawness of it. And, you know, it was actually quite easy, quite manageable. Am I answering your question well, your first question well enough? Yes. Actually, while you ask your questions, why don't you say your name for everyone's sake so you get to know each other a little bit more here.
Gil, I'm Jim Brother, and I just got back from doing chat in the valley. He was talking a lot of the time about heartfulness as distinct from mindfulness. And I wonder if you could maybe share your thoughts about that.
Heartfulness?
Yeah, heartfulness as a way of centering, being at the center.
I like the word heartfulness a lot. The word sati, which has been translated into as mindfulness into English, doesn't have the word mind in it. So it's kind of an English peculiarity that we call it mindfulness, because we put a lot of emphasis on the mind here in the West. So, and that's where we think our kind of awareness resides, is in our mind. And it's not good English, I suppose, and people confuse people. But in that, a lot of our mindfulness practice is very embodied. It could be bodyfulness, to experience ourselves and our world around us through our body, through our five senses, and I think anyone who does mindfulness for some time their body will awaken, and there'll be more sense of bodyfulness as part of that. Or it could also be heartfulness. The word for one of the words from that's translated as mind into English from Sanskrit and Pali has the double meaning of both mind and heart. And often in Southeast Asia, if you ask someone, where you think, I don't know if this is true for all Southeast Asians, but I certainly know it's true for the monastic teachers that I studied with there. Where do you think? And they'll point to the heart. This is where thinking happens. And if you ask a Westerner where they think, what do they tend to say? So there's a sense. So in the West, we talk about the heart as being a center for a lot of emotions, love and courage, but also fear is often centered here. So there's a lot of feelings we might have here. But heartfulness, in the sense that, then as people do practice mindfulness and as their body becomes more awake, I think it's the experience of a lot of people sooner or later that a sense of heartfulness also arises naturally out of the practice. A kind of sensitivity and a fullness and a kind of love or kindness, a gentleness that kind of seems to resonate perhaps from the heart. Certainly for me, it kind of seems to resonate from here. And, And the deeper my practice has been, the stronger this experience has been and developed. I remember when I practiced in Burma, there was a period of time where I just had tremendous experiences of love. And it seemed like love and mindfulness were completely intertwined in each other. And I would just bring my attention to pay attention, you know, bring my attention to pay attention to something. And the feeling was I was just, in deep states of meditation, your experience will often start to disappear. Your body will start to disappear and you won't have any body. So I'd be sitting there with a sense of a body, and I'd bring my attention to a part of my body, and I would just, the feeling was I would just love it into disappearing. I would just love it so thoroughly that it, so completely that it would just kind of dissolve and disappear. And so I would just, the whole body would dissolve, and you know, just by this light of love that would happen. And but I didn't dare tell my teacher this experience because, you know, he was kind of a tough cookie, and and this is a little bit too sentimental for him. And it doesn't have to be the way it was for me. You know, we all have particular experiences in meditation that are unique to ourselves. But the sense of as the normal preoccupations of our mind, the normal hindrances, the normal barriers and defenses that we have begin to quiet down and dissolve through the practice, then there's a kind of sensitivity that's left that can be called heartfulness. It's a kind of sensitivity that is imbued with kindness and gentleness and care, and because it's often a vulnerable or sensitive heart is often naturally that way. Now, my teacher in Burma certainly didn't teach heartfulness, but it certainly is a product of the practice. Now, what happens here in America is that a lot of Americans who practice have a lot of psychological issues that they have to resolve and deal with before they can actually get into some deeper stability or steadiness with the meditation practice. And for a lot of Westerners, the early period of the meditation practice is a kind of reorganizing of their psychology, a healing of their psychology, so that they can do the deeper work of practice that often involves completely letting go of any kind of concern with self. Their psychological issues often are very much tied up with our concerns of self. And some people, when they do the practice, will, after maybe 2 or 3 years, when their psychological issues are somehow resolved or helped or something, or settled to some degree, will no longer feel much attraction to doing meditation practice anymore, because what they came for was basically been taken care of. And then, you know, and then they'll go off and do something else with their life, which is quite fine. What I'm trying to say is that a lot of people in the West come with a lot of psychological pain, that of feelings of lack of self-worth, lack of self-love, lack of self-compassion, very critical of themselves, very judgmental towards themselves, very judgmental towards others. It's quite epidemic, and as a teacher I see it a lot in the people who come and talk to me. And so there's a tremendous need, and sometimes mindfulness practice, and they're just paying attention, this raw, what I call bare attention, just paying attention for things as they are, without any kind of elaborations, without any kind of attempt even to love it, just to simply see it as it is. It can be very difficult for some people who have a habit of being critical of whatever they see. So that the people confuse self-consciousness with self-awareness. So they become aware, if you have a habit of criticizing yourself, you'll get a lot of material if you start paying attention to what's going on inside of yourself. If you have a habit of being amused by what you see inside, you'll get lots of material also. And if you have a habit for being compassionate, you'll get lots of material to be compassionate towards. And so what a lot of people in the West, what they need to do is before they can really do deep meditative work, is they need to start learning how to have more compassion and kindness to what arises, as an antidote or as a substitute or as an alternative to the kind of self-criticalness or the confusion that often we have in the West. So some teachers then will stress the importance of kindness, of compassion, as a foundational to mindfulness practice. And perhaps that's what Jack was talking about. So, in the way that the practice unfolds traditionally, kindness and heartfulness arises in the course of practice. Some teachers will encourage you to develop that early on, not wait for the practice to do it for you, but to do some things to help you develop it. And loving kindness practice is one of those. And there are some people who would be much better off being taught loving kindness practice than being taught mindfulness practice. And was Jack teaching some loving kindness there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Isn't the integration of these two emotions, mindfulness and mindfulness, or mindfulness and
loving kindness?
No, mindfulness and the perception of truth.
Yes.
And mindfulness and the experience of mind is the other. It seems to me as the experience of simplicity.
So speak a little louder, please, for me.
Isn't that what we are attempting to experience? My deeper question is, I probably struggle with this, is it really possible to cultivate this?
This meaning the simplicity?
The practice of cultivating these things.
Uh-huh.
Is this not really defeating the experience? This is what
I'm thinking about. You find different teachers with different opinions about this question. So the question, the core of your question, as I understood it, is the very attempt to try to cultivate and develop presence, mindfulness, compassion, loving kindness, isn't that getting in the way? Isn't that self-defeating in some way? And we had Les Kay speak, it was last week, or 2 weeks ago, where he kind of talked. He took that point of view that the very desire to practice gets in the way of practice itself. It's like sandpaper. If you have a really coarse piece of wood, you want to use a really coarse piece of sandpaper to begin your work, and no one wants to start with a really fine piece of sandpaper if it's a really coarse piece of wood to begin with. And so you start with a really coarse one. At some point you have to realize the coarse piece of wood sandpaper is no longer needed because it's done its work. And if you keep using the coarse one, you won't get any smoother or the wood. So then you go to a finer grade sandpaper and use that for a while until you realize that that's not too coarse. And then you go to a finer one, a finer one, finer one, and to the point where all you're using is just a cloth. And at some point, even the cloth is too much, perhaps. So in that way, there might be some element. When the mind is very coarse, when the body, spirituality is very coarse, there's a lot that we can do to help develop ourselves. But we can only go that far. It's self-limiting at some point. And we have to shift the way in which we practice at some point when it's no longer working because it gets in the way. So initially it is a certain kind of desire that might get you here to sit might not be the desire you need to have while you're meditating. So you have to learn how to let go of the yearning and the hopefulness that got you here. But the fact that it got you here, that was really great. Am I speaking to your concern, do you think?
Yeah.
What do the rest of you think? Am I speaking to his concern? To the question? So I do believe it's possible to cultivate these things. Now when I was first introduced to Vipassana practice, I was also introduced to loving kindness practice. And I had practiced Zen practice for many years. And Zen is rather unemotional in its presentation. And it was, very kind of austere and very kind of very strict kind of way of practicing, unsentimental in a sense. Am I speaking loud enough, everyone? A lot more louder? We're going to try to get a speaker for the room that works, because I think this is happening too often that the voices don't carry. So you should. Great. maybe you can talk to Steve Gastner here. And you can have some encouragement that things will improve. When I was first in, I'd done Zen practice for many years, and when I was first introduced to Vipassana practice, I also learned about loving kindness, and that would have nothing to do with it, because it was too sentimental, and because it seemed too artificial. It seemed like it was, you're creating some feeling of love and kindness. It seemed artificial to do that, created out of nothing or something. And so as I did, I ignored it. When that part of the teaching came up, or with guided meditations could come up, I would just tune out the teacher. And then I would, but at some point, the practice of mindfulness itself will lead to experiences of kindness, of compassion, of loving kindness. And they started arising quite strongly in me on their own. And then when the teacher started doing loving kindness meditation, I had a really, really clear reference for it. And something was really close at hand. And then it made sense for me to kind of do the loving kindness practice as a way of calling forth what I really knew already. So I could then cultivate it and strengthen it because it was something I knew. And so I could cultivate it, I could develop it. But in my particular situation, I needed to let it become stronger on its own in my own practice before I could cultivate it. Some people don't have the same maybe blocks that I had, or the same narrowness of emotional experiences that I had, and maybe they can have access to loving kindness practice much easier and quicker, and don't have to wait, you know, after a long, long period of meditative practice to kind of slowly kind of tenderize the heart, to let it arise by itself. But I think you can cultivate these things, and what we have to be sensitive to is when the very effort to cultivate them needs to be modified. Because the very intentionality and our intentionality in how we practice, the yearning or the desire to which we practice, the intensity of practice, the kind of effort we're making in practice, might be inappropriate for the level of smoothness of the wood. And then you have to learn how to let go of certain kind of striving or intentiveness or roughness or energy and effort to get to something more subtle. And the course of practice is one that goes from coarser levels of the mind, coarser levels of effort, of experience, slowly as the practice settles to more and more refined, more and more refined, more subtle. But you don't want to be ahead of yourself either. Just when you accept where you're at. And if you need a coarse sandpaper, that's what you use. And it goes up and down. You know, practice isn't linear, like a really smooth line. It goes from, practice is more like, or... Yes.
My name is David. I realized today that my posture is still quite sloppy during meditation. I was wondering if you could review it.
David feels that his posture is sloppy while he meditates and wants to know if I can review posture. It seems like it takes a bit too long to kind of review posture, but what I can do is meet with you maybe individually, maybe after the sitting, just look at your posture, and that might be the most efficient way to kind of help you and more. So okay. you can experience from the inside of a good posture as opposed to just hearing words about it.
Yeah, that's what enters me, is the internal feeling.
It's considered to be very good karma in Buddhism to ask questions.
Guess I'll ask a question. What's the weather going to be like?
My name is Jim. On Monday night you talked about the eight winds, and I could only remember four of them. I think there was like praise and blame, success and failure, but all week I've been curious about the other ones, and it kind of rang a bell with me, so I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the eight winds.
Well, I think there's reason for you to be a little bit confused, because I gave a list of 8, and then at some point in the talk I also gave a list of 10. because I had 4 in my, I had 8 in my mind, and then I went and checked on a book, and 2 of the ones I had were not the ones in the classic list, but I thought the 2 I had were good. So I so and I'm, now in my mind I don't remember anymore exactly which is which, which is the true list and which is my list, but and some, maybe some of you will remember. But so success and failure, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and what's the opposite of fame?
Disgrace.
And well, that's 8. Is that good? Okay. Someone else remember 2 more? Anyway. Oh, these are the 8 winds. I call them the 8 winds, the 8 worldly dharmas. These are the kind of worldly concerns that many people might have that buffets them about in the winds of the world. So there's no stability in the mind or in the heart when we're easily thrown off track by fame or blame or success or failure or fame or disgrace or... pleasure and pain was one of them. Pleasure and pain. Pleasure and pain is, you know, a really big one that throws people back and forth. Because we're so many people are so assigned so much meaning and so much to pleasure and pain. And so it isn't just simply pleasure, or it isn't just simply pain in its rawness and nakedness. You know, it relates to a whole philosophy of life and who I am and what I need. And so we get buffeted about. So hopefully as you mature in the practice, what you're finding is that you're not blown about so much by these experiences. You know, when you get whether someone praises you or someone blames you for something, it doesn't affect your well-being in one bit, you know. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, my calling it the 8 winds is just kind of a light term, but certainly energetically, the way we get buffeted about our attachments and our fears and our excitement, energetically, what happens to us puts a strain on our body. You know, if we're very much concerned about praise, and someone spends a lot of time blaming you for something, it energetically can really depress you or really kind of agitate a person. And agitated, stressful, any kind of agitation and stress on the body will eventually have some kind of, you know, could affect your physical well-being. And the same thing about, you know, if you get a lot of praise, if you get endless great praise and you really get caught up in that praise, it might seem really good, but it's also putting a stress on the system. It's said that one of the most stressful experiences in a human life. I think I saw a list one of stressful experiences. You know, and things like dying is certainly stressful for a lot of people, having death happening. And then losing one's job is stressful. Retiring is stressful for some people. And then what surprised me was on the list was getting married. One of the, you know, up there in the top 4 most stressful experiences. And, you know, usually marriage is quite joyful for those people who are brave. But you know, but there's a lot of stress involved, even in joy. Can be. Yes. Sarah.
Uh-huh. Could you say something about the process from the Zen practice to the
Asana? I mean, how I got from one to the other?
Yes, and also how if you felt.
Well, so she wants to know about my experience of going from Zen to Vipassana and whether I felt torn or any conflict between the two. And I think it's very important to say that these kinds of questions are very personal in nature, in the sense that not necessarily private, but they're very individual in nature. So so there's no need to kind of take my example and generalize that this is the way things should be for other people. Some people make very clear choices between one or the other, or different traditions of Buddhism. In my situation, I kind of stumbled onto Vipassana, somewhat by, not exactly by accident, but I was studying in the monasteries, Zen monasteries in Japan, and I had to leave Japan to get a new visa to stay in Japan. And it just worked out, because of airfares and what was convenient, for me to fly to Bangkok to get the new visa. And being a Zen priest in, you know, in Thailand, you know, what do you do? You know, I wasn't going to go to the beach or go to the red light district or some of the things that people are famous for. So and I was very interested in not so much the meditation of Southeast Asia, but I was interested in the whole system of contemplative psychology that existed in Southeast Asia. And as I was flying there to Thailand, I had this idea, well, I could either go travel around all the different monasteries and just ask questions and study from under a lot of different teachers and get a lot of information, or I can learn about this contemplative psychology in the context of meditation, and I could just go to the first meditation monastery I find and just say, here I am, and I'll do whatever you tell me to do. So I had a little address for a little kind of funky little meditation monastery in the outsides of Bangkok. So I went there, and that's what I did. I said, here I am, tell me what to do. And it was a Vipassana center. I didn't really know much about Vipassana. And I applied for my visa, and it took me 10 weeks to realize that the visa wasn't going to come. So I was just I'd resolved just to sit there quietly in meditation until the visa came. So I did it. My first Vipassana retreat was 10 weeks long, just 10 weeks of silence and 10 weeks of just sitting and walking and practicing all day long. And that was a long enough to kind of an accident. I just kind of stumbled into it, thanks to the Japanese embassy and cheap airfares and Korean Airlines. And but 10 weeks was long enough to get my attention. And it became, it got my attention in a very deep way, and it became existentially very important for me to kind of continue what had started during that 10-week retreat. And so it wasn't a matter of choosing Zen over Vipassana because, you know, one was better than the other for me. It was more that an inner process had gotten started in the Vipassana practice that I had to complete. And so it took me a while, it took me almost a year to be able to get back to Thailand and Southeast Asia. And then I continued that process, practicing more and more deeply. And then after some time, I came back to America. And I came back to America with the idea of doing more intensive Vipassana practice. But I'd done so much intensive practice. I had done 8 months of this just before that, of just 8 months of being not talking to anyone, just practicing all day and all most of the night. And I was a little bit psychically tired, and it wasn't appropriate to kind of continue more intensive practice for a while. So I'd come back to America with the idea of doing more intensive practice in America, finding that it wasn't appropriate. And then I went to live at Green Gulch, which is a Zen center, and was very happy there, continued with my Zen practice there. And then after a year, then I continued with some more intensive Vipassana practice. And when I finished the next round of intensive Vipassana practice, I very happily went back to Zen center and continued practicing there. And I never felt that I had to choose one or the other, like, you know, like one was a truth and one was, you know, false. And I actually have to this day a great love for both of them, and I feel they're both very skillful, very useful practices in their own right. They're different, and I see the differences that each has their strength and each has their weaknesses. And maybe because I practice so much in both, I'm very cognizant of the strengths and weaknesses of both. Our scene, our Vipassana scene, certainly has weaknesses. And I'm the first to admit that one's at least the ones I know about. And the Zen practice also has its weaknesses, but each of them have their strengths. So rather than choosing, I'm still involved in both traditions. I never came to points where I had to choose one or the other. And I love both of them. But you know, my primary involvement these days is mostly in the world of Vipassana, and I'm very happy with that. You know, I have a great respect and love for Zen practice also. That's a very personal answer.
Were you studying, did you have a teacher in
Sure. Yes?
How do you work with, I know you're helping out the
his attention? If anything, I spend a lot more time trying to distract him than trying to teach him to be attentive, for sure. Do this instead. You know, he's fighting with some other kid about something, you know, wants something, and look at this interesting thing here. That's much better than telling him to pay attention to your feelings now, and, you know. I work on myself. At this age, I work on myself.
At what age can you create?
This is something I don't know much about. Though we have this children's program on Mondays, and the youngest children who've come have been 7, and they seem to have enjoyed it. They keep coming back, and so I get a sense that, you know, there's not, you know, the parents say that, you know, things are kind of going in by osmosis, and I one of the most popular classes I did was on eating meditation, and we did a whole series of eating. I had them close their eyes, and I would put surprise foods, you know, in their mouth, mango and strawberry with chocolate, and, you know, and chocolate, and they had to kind of really eat it really mindfully and tell me what it was that was in their mouth, and they were really surprised how much flavor there was when they really ate it that way, and they had such a great time. And so they would talk, well, some of them, when they went home, would sometimes tell their parents about, you know, eating mindfully. Or in discourses of the Buddha, there's accounts, I don't know if they're mythical or not, but there's accounts of people becoming enlightened when they were 7. There seems to be something magical that happens, I don't know, magical or something, something developmental, at least in the discourses, that happens at the age 7. Maybe at age 7 people are developed enough that some kind of transformation of consciousness can occur. I don't know if it's mythical or what, but these stories. But it's something I don't know much about. You have to ask me in 10 years.
Cheryl, my wife was working with our neighbor's child, who was 10, has a lot of problems, anger, and she's saying it's really very receptive to her. It's really helping her a lot.
Oh, I have a wonderful tape. John Kabat-Zinn, in one of his courses, talked about the work of a fifth grade teacher in Salt Lake City who was teaching mindfulness to her fifth grade class. And it's a fantastic story. I don't know, what grade are you? How old are you in fifth grade?
Seven.
So maybe fifth grade is 10. Is 10. So definitely by the time they're this class learned so much about mindfulness in the course of the year. And some of the kids in the class, the way they reported, had just really made a huge difference. Some of the more problem kids in the class. So certainly by the time a kid is 10, they can learn a lot about mindfulness. And maybe it could be, you know, stretched earlier.
The Kabat-Zinn's book, Everyday Blessings. You read that book? Everyday Blessings. You know, childhood.
My sense at this age with my son is not so much teaching him mindfulness as being an example of certain values, of certain ways of being in the world. And hopefully that's what he picks up, rather than, because he's kind of a sponge for mimicking others. So how we behave and what we say and what we do is, you know, what he learns what he learns about how to be a human being. He's now 22 months. So sometimes my wife and I will bow to our food before we eat dinner, so sometimes he kind of goes, you know, we have never asked him or told him to do it, right? You know, but he goes. Yes.
David again. You mentioned that the Pathman and Dharma have different strengths and weaknesses, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit.
David wants to know about the strengths and weaknesses of Zazen and Vipassana. There's a lot to be said on this topic, so I'll just say a few things briefly. These, of course, are broad generalizations that don't apply to all schools of Zen and all schools of Vipassana. Vipassana and Zen are not just each thing is a thing in itself. There's like all these different schools, and, you know, it's like as you say, you know, Christianity, you know, it's like all these different schools of Christianity, and there's all these different ways of practicing Vipassana. Some Vipassana teachers are closer to, you know, Zen teachers than others, you know, it all depends. But as a generalization, Zen practice errs on the side of discipline, of toughening things out, of just for example, if you feel some pain in your body, in Zen practice you're not supposed to move, you just sit there and just be with it. In Vipassana practice, we err on the side of self-indulgence. We err on the side of being too careful. And maybe you can't be too careful. Maybe if you err in one direction, it's better to err on the side of being too careful. But Vipassana students, you know, tend to be a little bit too self-indulgent with themselves. You know, and they don't develop a strong sense of discipline as some Zen students do. So, you know, some difficulty arises on retreat. You know, they'll go take a bath, or take a nap, and you know, and wander off, you know, and go for a walk in the woods, you know, and you know, take care of themselves. And sometimes that's really an appropriate thing to do. And I don't want to make fun of it, you know, exactly. But oftentimes that can also be shortchanging oneself. And rather than using the practice to really get deeper beyond our self-indulging, our self-preoccupation, we're actually subtly feeding it and developing it. In Zen, you can't do that very easily because you can't get up from your meditation and go take a bath. You have to be there, you have to follow the schedule and just be really strict about it. And what happens in Zen then, some people will damage themselves, physically even. I've known lots of Zen students who've had knee surgery. Whereas it's pretty rare in Vipassana world for people to have knee surgery because, you know, partly in mindfulness we're being really mindful of what's going on. You can tell the difference between pain which is damaging and pain that's not. Zen practice doesn't focus so much on that kind of careful mindfulness of our experience. So there isn't that kind of, you don't pick up the information from the body of when you need to take care of the body better. One of the shortcomings of Zen is that because it tends to be a much more formal practice, all these forms and robes and ways of being, people can hide in the forms. People can kind of do the form just the way they're set up to be done and feel and think they're a really good Zen student and kind of protect themselves from any kind of scrutiny about personal or from other people about what's really going on with them. And there are people who spend years in a Zen temple kind of hiding from themselves in the forms. There has historically been a tendency in America for the Zen people in Zen tradition, in the early years at least, to be kind of samurai spirit and kind of tough, and there'd be a lot of discipline and kind of unkindness in the scene. And in the last 15 years, that's changed dramatically, I feel, compared to what it was like 20 years ago. And now in the Zen traditions that I know about, there's much more kindness. And they even chant the Loving Kindness Sutra now in the morning, which they didn't do before. They borrowed it from us. And one of the shortcomings of the Vipassana scene is that the way it's set up in America, it tends to be very individual in nature. It's each person's individual experience is kind of their own experience. So it reinforces a kind of individuality, individualism that exists here in America. And it's possible for some Vipassana students to kind of actually become more self-centered through the practice rather than becoming unself-centered in the way the practice is designed. My practice is most important, and people everybody else, please don't bother me. And in Zen practice, there tends to be much stronger emphasis on practicing in relationship to other people and cultivation of compassion and feeling that your practice is something you're doing in relationship to other people in the world, not something you're just doing for yourself, for your own well-being, but you're doing the practice for the sake of others. Though ultimately, you know, I believe that these practices are not so different. If you follow both practices thoroughly and doing really well and really honestly, I think both practices will lead you to the same place, basically the same place. There'll be some differences, though the differences might not be that important. It's kind of the, one of the classic images that the Buddha gave for enlightenment. He said, just as fresh water tastes the same everywhere you go, so the taste of enlightenment is the same for everyone. So basically something like that. I don't have it quite right. And I believe that's the case, that the experience of freedom, of awakening, is something that we all can share and get a taste of. However, most of us don't drink fresh water just straight out of the stream. We drink it in glass. And the nature of the glass affects the kind of experience we have while we're drinking the pure water. If you drink pure water out of a wonderful Japanese tea bowl, it's a very different experience than going down to McDonald's and drinking it out of a styrofoam cup. I think experience is different, even though the taste is the same. And so I think different Buddhist traditions have different glasses they hold the water in. And your experience will be a little bit different depending on the glass you have. And that's not necessarily good or bad, it's just the nature of it. I mean, every individual sangha will have a different glass and container that it has. We always need to have a container. It's valuable to have to try out different containers sometimes, so you realize that your container is just a container, not the truth. So, it was nice for me just to hear your questions and concerns. I hope it was nice for you today to hear each other's concerns and questions and have this kind of discussion for a change. And in the months that we've been having a Sunday morning program, I developed a great fondness for it, and I feel it's very, very valuable that we meet here Sunday morning, those of you who come here, and I hope that all of you will think of your involvement with Sunday morning not just something you're doing for your individual selves, but that you, when you show up here, you're also supporting other people who are here. You're getting supported by them, and you're offering support just by your very presence of sitting here. So I want to thank all of you for the support you give all of us. Thank you.